In February, Paramount Skydance announced that it had entered an agreement to acquire Warner Bros. Discovery, a legacy media company that is not only a major studio, but the owner of HBO, CNN, and many other media properties. The proposed acquisition would combine two of Hollywood's major studios and bring an extraordinary collection of television, film, cable, and streaming assets under one corporate roof. As is typical in a large merger of this type, the Justice Department investigated the deal, but decided not to challenge it. But then, 12 state attorney generals have gone to federal court seeking to block it, arguing that the combination violates antitrust laws. What is the theory behind that suit? How is it likely to unfold? We're lucky to be joined by Patrick Neville, an antitrust expert from Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, to help us sort it out. Parsons Bailey is a KPCW financial supporter. Morning, Patrick. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, Roger. Thanks for having me.
So, Patrick, before we get into the legal weeds, what exactly is Paramount buying, and why is this such a significant media merger?
Yeah, so Paramount wants to buy all of Warner Bros. Discovery, which is one of the largest entertainment companies in the world. It includes streaming services like HBO Max, basic cable TV channels like MTV, TNT, and CNN. There's also major motion picture studios that include Warner Bros. Motion Pictures and DC Studios, who are responsible for films and important franchises like Harry Potter and The Dark Knight. And there's also a heap of other brands and entertainment networks that are involved in this deal. So it's significant and getting a lot of media attention because of its scale. And if we look at it, even price tag aside, the proposed merger would create a combined company that controls two of Hollywood's big five film studios. And it would also combine two of the nation's largest owners of basic cable TV channels.
And, you know, the Justice Department has these pre-merger review requirements. And back when I was a practicing lawyer, we used to get these second requests. Obviously, Justice had to have looked at this transaction before concluding that it was not likely to harm competition, which is an interesting conclusion to me, given what you just said. But then the 12 states sued to block it. How unusual is it for the state attorney generals to step up when the federal government has given it a pass?
You know, it's unusual, but it's not unheard of. So historically, state attorney generals would often join forces with their federal counterparts to pursue mergers like this one that might impact their citizens. And this was largely driven by a lack of dedicated antitrust personnel or other limited resources at the state level. But I think what we're starting to see is that this trend is starting to change. The states are looking at what this current administration is doing, and they've concluded that, you know, it's unacceptable from an antitrust perspective. So we're seeing attorney generals in both Democrat and Republican-led states that are starting to cast a wider net. They're building out their antitrust divisions and even coordinating amongst each other to maximize resources.
And from a big picture perspective, leaving aside this particular deal, when you're looking at what I think they call a horizontal merger, because there's a lot of commonality between the two companies, what are the sort of standards they're looking for? How do they sort of, from a biggest of big picture perspectives, how do you look at that from an antitrust perspective?
You know, they're looking at whether these two competitors in the market itself to see the levels of competition between them to determine whether or not, to use a little legalese here, the merger would substantially lessen competition or result in a monopoly. So that comes directly from Section 7 of the Clayton Act, which is the relevant statute here in this case. And conventionally, that type of merger analysis, particularly in a horizontal merger, so two competitors merging, regulators are going to examine the relevant market, the degree of overlap between the two merging firms, and then the changes in market concentration to try to determine if this merged entity would in fact substantially lessen competition.
And in some of the publicity I've seen, you know, Paramount likes to point out that DOJ blessed it. Does the fact that the government blessed it at the federal level, how will that affect the court in the state court level? Does the federal court litigation brought by the states, does it basically start on a clean slate? Does the DOJ's perspective on this have any impact at all?
So the short answer is there's no binding legal significance of the DOJ's analysis. States have their own statutory authority to pursue claims under the Clayton Act, regardless of what the federal government decides to do. That being said, DOJ does usually conduct like a pretty intensive pre-merger investigation that involves a substantial volume of document discovery, interviews, and even depositions. Now, the states, of course, will want to conduct their own discovery and have their own experts analyze the contours that are specific to their case. But in this sense, I wouldn't call it like a clean slate.
Okay. All right. So from my own sort of limited experience in antitrust law back in the day, the first question I remember them asking is, what's the relevant market? So let's talk about how you define the relevant market and what markets do the states say at this point are going to be too concentrated after this merger?
Yeah, so the market analysis is one of, if not the most important inquiry in merger cases like this one. And that's because it's going to impact the assessment of market power, the assessment of competitive effects. But I should be very clear here, because relevant market is a term of art in antitrust law. So in antitrust law, the relevant market defines the boundaries in which competition is going to be evaluated. And it typically has two parts, a product market, which is really looking at substitutable goods, and a geographic market, where competition occurs. You know, it's a really fact-intensive and economic analysis that is meant to determine what goods or services compete with the goods or services that are offered by the parties at issue. So typically, it requires some analysis of demand elasticity, which is a fancy way of saying whether consumers would switch from one product to another in response to a price increase. If consumers would switch, those alternative products might belong in the same market. So let me give you an example just to kind of clarify this, because I'm talking a lot here. But say we have an antitrust case that has to do with ski resorts in Utah. You know, the plaintiff might argue that the relevant market is only downhill skiing in Salt Lake City. Mm-hmm. But the defendant will likely push back and say, oh, people can take their money. They can do something else with it. They might go golfing in St. George, say. So if buyers would in fact switch, if they would take their money in response to a price increase at the ski resorts and go golfing, those alternatives might belong in the same market. Now, you can guess the answer to that question is likely no, right? It's a silly example. But the question gets harder if the defendants argued, oh, maybe it should just be cross-country skiing at Mountaindale. And so again, it's a silly example I'm giving you here, but I think the idea is you can see how defendants have an incentive to argue that the market should be defined as broadly as possible. The broader the market, the more room there is for competition. And so in this case, in this case, the states have alleged three distinct markets. They have a wide release theatrical market, which are films intended for broad initial release in movie theaters. Then there are these tentpole or blockbuster films, which is a subset of wide release films that the states claim have this even higher level of confidence of revenue generation. So they believe it's a submarket as that's part of this wide ranging film distribution market. And finally, we've got basic cable. So scheduled real-time programming that's sold to distributors like cable distributors, YouTube TV, folks of that nature.
And I take it that the states are going to argue that, and I take it that we can anticipate Paramount saying, well, wait a minute, there's a lot of substitutability between films and streaming and all these other ways of accessing entertainment.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we've already seen the indication that Paramount believes this merger is pro-competitive because it'll create a stronger rival in the streaming marketplace to dominant players like Amazon and Netflix that already exist. So it will be a really fact-intensive inquiry to see that the court was going to have to do to evaluate these arguments.
And does the law look at just the number, taking the major studios question, is it the number of major studios, or does the government or the state's going to have to sort of argue a little bit more that we can anticipate higher prices or reduced output?
You know, it's a really good question. I think a lot is made of this idea that in this case, particularly, it's a 5-4 merger, meaning there are five large entities and it's a concentrated market, and we're going to be reduced to four in an even more highly concentrated market. But I would say high market concentration is typically a warning sign. It's not the whole answer. So to put it differently, the lessening of competition, thinking back to our Section 7 of the Clayton Act, is more apparent in concentrated markets. And I think that makes intuitive sense. You know, you can consider a scenario where the market only has three players. If two of those entities were to merge, you know, there might be more antitrust risk that new combined entity could increase prices on its own. Or given the limited number of players,
maybe there's going to be some coordination between the firms after the merge. But you can see the opposite is also true. If there are 30 firms in the market and two of them merge, there's a lot more room for competition. And I'll also say that this idea of market concentration has already played a pretty big role in this case. And that comes from the court's granting of the state's temporary restraining order. It relied pretty heavily on this concept, and specifically a well-known Supreme Court case called Philadelphia National Bank. So to give you a little context, Philadelphia National Bank is a Supreme Court case that establishes this precedent that certain mergers are so likely to lessen competition that they should be prohibited absent clear evidence to the contrary. Now, the court didn't provide specific numbers in that case, but it did say that a post-merger market share that's at least 30% or higher gives rise to this presumption of illegality. Hmm. So it's important to note that this is a rebuttable presumption. The merging entities can still defend the transaction by showing that the deal won't cause these anti-competitive harms. But to be very clear, I want to circle back to your question because I'm going, it's a long-winded answer to respond. You know, contemporary economic theory does suggest now that concentration, it definitely needs to be considered, but it's not determinative. And that gets to the idea that concentration does not always lead to higher prices. You might just have a better mousetrap. So regulators often couple the showing of high market concentration with something else. And that's likely what the plaintiff states will have to do here. They'll have to show some evidence that the merger will foreclose competition, raise prices for consumers, decrease choice, or otherwise create a bad effect in the relevant market.
We're going to come back to more about the state's case, but I want to talk a little bit about the Writers Guild case because this is interesting to me. The Writers Guild does a separate lawsuit claiming that reducing the number of competing studios would give the companies better bargaining power over the writers. And I think this is something called monopsony. Can you sort of explain what monopsony is and talk a little bit about this theory?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right. The typical merger analysis often asks whether the combined firm can raise prices for consumers. A monopsony, on the other hand, it asks the mirror image question, focusing on buyer power. So whether the merged firm can push down what it pays to its suppliers. In other words, can a single buyer control the demand for a product or service, giving them the power, the combined entity, to set these lower prices and dictate terms to the suppliers? Now, in this case, the suppliers are the screenwriters, the talent. And I think there is some inherent appeal to this argument. If the screenwriters can shop their script to five major studios, it can force those studios to bid and negotiate against one another for better terms. But if you take that buyer away, the screenwriter's next best option gets worse. And at least that's the Writers Guild's theory of the case.
And again, on this one, what kind of evidence are they going to be able to introduce? What are they going to have to try to do to show this? Is it going to be just economic theory? Because it's not like they can say this is what was definitely going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. And I've got a long-winded response, so bear with me. But there is some precedent for this kind of monopsony A-list screenwriter talent case. So when Penguin Random House tried to buy Simon & Schuster back in 2022, the DOJ was able to block the deal. And the court agreed with DOJ that combining two of these big five book publishers would harm competition in the market for anticipated top-selling books. And more specifically, it would cause harm to author payments due to reduced competition. So in that case, though, the relevant market was not all books, but a narrower segment where buyers competed for these marquee works. So we can see that if we apply a similar framework here, there's at least a plausible claim for the few screenwriters that compete for these wide release films. Now, proving this concept, like you said, is very tricky. And I would guess that if the Writers Guild are going to try to do so, they'll have to follow a paradigm very similar to what the DOJ did in Penguin Random House, excuse me. So first, they will need to provide evidence of market concentration so they can take advantage of that 30% market share presumption from Philadelphia National Bank. And of course, that will likely turn on the market definition, and that will be a big battleground in this case moving forward. But second, in terms of evidence, they likely can't rely just on evidence of market concentration. they'll need some evidence of anti-competitive effects. And in Random House, the DOJ presented this evidence in a variety of ways. They presented multiple expert models that attempted to quantify the anticipated harm to authors. They also used qualitative evidence. And they pointed to an evidence of a history of collusion among the participants in the market, and even provided testimony from authors like Stephen King, who testified that the merger will likely harm competition. So the Writers Guild will probably take a similar approach here. They will definitely use expert testimony and attempt to quantify any alleged harm, but I wouldn't be surprised if they also use qualitative evidence and testimony from screenwriters.
This sounds like a very fact-intensive trial that's going to take a while, and I would guess both of these would take a while.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, like you said, this is a fact-intensive and expert-driven analysis. I think right now the judge has set the case for a 12-day trial starting in March. But
how can that be?
You know, there's a good chance that some of these issues are established before we even get to trial.
Yeah.
You know, the parties might move for summary judgment on the market definition, which will be a large fight, or other of these kind of legal issues to try to narrow the issues for trial.
And again, going back to market definition, I think one of the interesting things that may come out of here is an argument about the relationship between studio films in theatrical releases and the streaming services. You know, where do I define where consumer choice might drive that? And that's a really sort of very current 21st century question, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a really interesting argument. And I'll say that Microsoft made a similar argument a few years ago when they were alleged to have market power over the operating systems and internet browsers. You know, and they claimed that this constant innovation and low barriers to entry meant that a competitor could easily replace them at any time. Now, they lost that argument, but if we look back, you know, things were evolving. Just maybe not as quickly as Microsoft argued. So that's why this is such a fascinating case. You know, has streaming fundamentally changed any of the markets in question in such a way that these large studios can no longer be found to have market power? You know, it's almost certainly the exact reason why that they decided to merge in the first place. But I think Paramount will face some similar challenges that Microsoft face, you know, which is proving that streaming has really changed the competitive landscape in a way that lessens market power. You know, I don't buy the argument because streaming services are dominated by a handful of participants. And the relevant market analysis that we talked through at a pretty high level allows for a consideration of competition, regardless of whether or not there's a new method of competing. So I don't think it's the most persuasive thing in the world, but others do disagree.
Another aspect of this that has gotten some publicity is the idea that the merger would put CBS News and CNN under the same corporate ownership. And you know, there's always expressed concerns about concentration in the news gathering business. Is that like another element that would have to get looked at? Will there be arguments about that from an antitrust perspective?
You know, it's unlikely in this case. Concentration of news ownership could be an antitrust problem if it caused, you know, competitive commercial harm. But I think the specific concern about a loss of diverse viewpoints is largely outside the scope of this case. This case is concerned about the concentration of not just news, but the market for basic cable TV as a whole.
I want to talk a little bit about chess now. And what I mean by that is the moves that the parties have taken so far. So on the one hand, you know, we have the states coming in and saying to the judge, hey, put a freeze on this until we figure this out. And typically you would see, I would expect, Paramount to react, no, don't do that. Let's keep going. And particularly because there is the economics of the $7 million a day ticking fee that starts in October and runs until the deal closes. Paramount didn't do that. They agreed. Talk to me about what their calculation was. Why would they do that?
You know, I think from Paramount's perspective, they're trying to push this deal through. And they believe that the best way to do that, especially with the court that's already starting to align with the state's theory of the case, might be just to get to trial. It's a calculated risk. It also could just be that they think it's the fastest way to actually get this merger through. So from that ticking fee perspective, I definitely think that they are feeling some financial strain from this. So they might have made a calculated decision to say that this is the fastest way to get a resolution of this case.
My amateur observation of this was, I think they asked for like an October trial date, and the states asked for like an April trial date, and the judge puts a trial in March. I think they guessed wrong, right? I think they thought that by agreeing, they would get an early trial date.
I agree. And from my perspective, or they were just trying to split the baby somewhere in the middle. I would be surprised if they thought there would be no discovery in this case. You know, the state's case is different than the DOJ's analysis, which did focus more on streaming. So I'm not surprised that they would need more time to do their own expert discovery in this case before trial.
Now, this ticking fee is an interesting sort of pressure point. And often in these merger cases, there are ways in which people try to figure out, how can I settle? And I can you talk about, you know, those kinds of strategies? And usually it's things like shedding particularly business units. What are you thinking about that? Is that a possibility here?
Yeah, so I think the settlement dynamics are one of the most interesting aspects of this case. So I'm going to answer your question in the context of this specific case. I think that the plaintiff states and the Writers Guild are clearly negotiating from a position of power, right? They, regardless of the merits of their antitrust case, there are some clear financial concerns for Paramount. We have that ticking fee, that costly ticking fee you already mentioned. And like we've kind of discussed, time does matter. The longer you put off a merger, the more likely it is that it might not happen. And this could be because financing falls through or other business-related reasons. And I don't want to say that Paramount is in this position, but typically, the longer we go, the less likely the deal is to go through. Plus, trial is a huge risk. And that's true for both sides. But like we talked about, the court is at least right now finding that the plaintiff state's claim has some viability. So it's going to be really interesting to see how these settlement dynamics play out. And Paramount is already trying to flip the script. You know, recently, their CEO, David Ellison, has said that they'll start the process of moving Paramount out of California if the states refuse to settle. Now, California's attorney general has not taken the bait. He's called this an attempt to blackmail the states, and it doesn't seem like this attempt by Paramount is going to work. But I will say, I do think there are signs that the state might be willing to settle if the right concessions are on the table. And I would imagine it would have to be some sort of structural remedy. So some sort of divestiture of part of the business rather than behavioral. So a behavioral remedy would be like Paramount guaranteeing to do 30 films every year moving forward. I don't think the states will buy into that kind of behavioral argument, especially given the posture of this case. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like Paramount has been willing to go that route just yet. But we'll see what happens as this case gets closer to trial and those ticking fees rack up.
And the legal fees rack up. They have put together a group of law firms, Paramount. You know, I cannot imagine how much they are spending on legal fees. And every time I see another article, they've hired somebody else. It's really quite extraordinary. And, you know, I wonder, you got, you know, full-time state employees on the other side. I wonder if they're feeling a little overwhelmed.
You know, it's true. Paramount and Warner Bros. Have some of the biggest names in antitrust litigation on their side right now. I will say that the states also have private counsel. So I feel like they like the way things are going so far. So I don't think the states are feeling too much pressure in that regard.
Okay, get out your crystal ball, Patrick. How is this thing likely to play out? What would worry you most on the state side? What would worry you most on the Paramount Warner side?
Yeah, I mean, there are a variety of things that are interesting about this case. I think the easiest answer for both parties is market definition. But putting that aside, if I were the states, I think I would be concerned about proving some type of direct anti-competitive harm. So far, the complaint and even the court's ruling on the temporary restraining order rely really heavily on this market share presumption from Philadelphia National Bank. So, And I expect that they will do more discovery on this, of course, but I think that's what I would be most concerned about, is building up the evidence of our case. For Paramount, the concern is almost the inverse. I think the biggest concern is this court's a ruling on the temporary restraining order. The ruling, again, focuses largely on this Philadelphia National Bank presumption. And it's interesting because it focuses just on one of the markets alleged, this wide-release film market, where the combined entity would only have 27% market share. So less than the 30% number that often triggers the presumption. And I think that gives some indication as to how the court is viewing these issues. And clearly, they think there's the court thinks there's some anti-competitive concerns here.
My last question is strictly a handicap one. Is it likely to go to trial?
You know, that's the toughest question. I think Paramount has a lot of people and have indicated that they're willing to fight this all the way to the Supreme Court. Personally, I think this case will settle before trial. I think anything can happen at trial. It's a large risk for both sides, and nobody might leave trial happy. So I think a settlement might be the best way to alleviate both the financial pressure on Paramount and make sure the states get the remedy that they're hoping for.
We've been speaking with Patrick Neville of Parsons, Bailey & Latimer about the Paramount Warner Brothers antitrust case brought by the states. Thanks for sharing your wisdom with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.